Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for providing this great facility this evening. As you know, we have two speakers talking on the topic of a political update setting the scene for 2020 and two of Australia's most influential and significant columnists. So we're going to start off with Jennifer Hewitt, who, as you know, is the National Affairs columnist for the Australian Financial Review, and then Paul Kelly, who, as you know, is editor-at-large for The Australian. So Jennifer will speak for about 15 minutes. Paul will speak for about 15 minutes. We'll take no more than 30 minutes of discussion. Because there are a lot of people here, keep your comments or questions in the discussion period brief. So, Jennifer, many thanks.
Thanks, Gerard. Very nice to be here. So I'll, start by looking at the update for 2020, which seems to change basically almost every day. I think the consolation for Scott Morrison is that the political outlook for the year looked even worse in February 2019 than it does in February 20. He didn't lose his confidence or conviction then, and he won't now. But given early 2020 has not gone at all according to plan, even before the coronavirus struck, it's far from certain that the Prime Minister can regain the necessary political momentum and personal authority he lost over such a torrid summer that he didn't see coming. We're obviously all more sceptical of polls these days, but for many quiet Australians, he seems to have lost his sheen. Most committed Liberal voters haven't given up on him and are still just willing to excuse his mistakes, assuming he learns from them. Those who dislike him now dislike him even more passionately. But as usual, it's the reaction of those voters who are not committed but who did back the Coalition and Morrison personally, directly or via preferences at the last election, that are making the government far more nervous. I was in Canberra last week for the return of Parliament, and the mood of hubris that was evident at the end of last year is certainly shaken. Not, however, the sense of aggravation that Morrison gets an unfair deal from the media, including now the condemnation of most international media and much of the public debate. Weirdly, by week's end, though, there was almost a relief amongst backbenchers that the opening of Parliament hadn't been quite as bad as it might have been, despite the Nationals, because Labor seemed unable to capitalise on the Coalition's much weakened state, and that there's time to improve. But there's certainly a belated acceptance that a series of misjudgments means the government needs to rapidly reset. Morrison was certainly rattled by the reaction and has been unusually in apology mode, even willing to say an occasional sorry, as the Labor Party tries to define him as arrogant. But recovery won't be straightforward for the Coalition, as the continuing ructions over personalities and policy in the National Party have demonstrated yet again. Last week, today, next week, inevitably. Despite the claims, you know, Michael McCormack is unlikely to be Deputy PM by the time of the next election, probably much sooner. With all the disruptions and arguments and internal party criticisms being part of the story in the meantime, the junior partner is divided, but inevitably headed into the direction of being more Barnaby-like, aggressive, including giving Scott Morrison the much more public trouble on issues like climate change policy and support for coal. Witness just this afternoon the embarrassment of the vote today for what should be a minor post of deputy speaker in a way, in favour of somebody called Lou O'Brien, a man few people had ever heard of prior to his resignation from the National Party, but yet Labor was able to stir up trouble very successfully this afternoon. The more that sort of division happens, the weaker a Prime Minister looks in his ability to manage his government, let alone the country. Queensland obviously doesn't just spell trouble for Labor leaders, and control of the numbers in Parliament is just looking a little shakier. Morrison, however, will definitely go to the election as PM, despite the instant exaggerated enthusiasm of his many opponents that he can't last. How successfully he does, though, however, will depend on how much he can assert control over the policy and political agenda from now on. In that sense, the sports rorts affair and the latest arguments over the unbalanced distribution of another $150 million under the so-called female facilities and water safety stream are peripheral issues. But they do reflect an image that Morrison was previously so good at challenging, of corrupted politics and politicians on the make. In other words, the business of politics as usual. Morrison has famously said he's governing for the people who don't like paying much attention to politics. But playing daggy dad, going to the football and sounding like an ordinary family man won't be near enough by the end of this year. He needs to be back in the business of being seen to be delivering real results. What happens to the economy is obviously key to that, with much of it, like China's economic growth and now the impact of the coronavirus, certainly beyond Canberra's control, as Morrison and Frydenberg keep in saying. We are seeing, obviously, the alternative to the enormous economic boost, if not free ride, that China has given this country for well over a decade, and how vulnerable we are, probably more than any other developed country, to any sudden reduction in that massive contribution. It's still too soon to be sure just how bad or extended this contraction of Chinese demand will be, but just that it will be very bad as the weeks continue. The Treasurer and Prime Minister instantly celebrated the RBA judgment, initially expressed by Phil Lowe last week, that the economy would continue to grow at 2.75% this year and 3% next year as evidence that Australia's economic fundamentals remain very strong. In private, they were actually far more surprised by his relative optimism. The combination of the impact of the coronavirus, then the drought, followed by the bushfires, is just the latest challenge for an economy that's been struggling, clearly, to get traction domestically. That's despite the government boasts of the economy's resilience, its jobs growth, its strong exports, and a housing market that's booming again, probably too much so. And that's all true. Australia's exports of minerals, metals and energy commodities reached a record new high of $290 billion last year, up 17% from 2018. Yet, while economic management remains a traditional coalition strength, another year of low wages and sluggish growth at best will foment cries for the government to do more to spur growth and improve living standards, coming from everyone, from the Reserve Bank down to the business community, to the outer suburbs, housing Morrison's favoured political species. But Morrison's a leader who's made a political virtue of delivering on past election promises rather than on calls for major change in future, on maintaining traditional rules rather than attempting new directions, of cautious incrementalism rather than dramatic reform. Morrison won the election warning of Labor's risks and taxes, not by selling the coalition's future agenda in any detail. So Morrison was never likely to attempt major structural changes such as systemic trade-offs for real reform of the tax system, for example. He plays it safe in tactical terms. It still means this government risks going through this year looking reactive and flat-footed in terms of having any longer-term strategy for a stronger future. This was always going to make 2020 the crucial action year between elections, particularly challenging to sustain a sense of momentum, even before the bushfires. A budget surplus may be good, it was never going to be sufficient of itself, and now it can no longer be held up as the government's holy grail anyway, given the uncertainty of the risks facing the economy, global and domestic. The new budget mantra is instead on the human cost rather than fiscal cost. Tough decisions on spending, typical of a first-past-the-election budget, will certainly not be a priority for this government in 2020, as it instead emphasises its previous discipline, now gives it the wherewithal to provide help when needed. So if we look at the budget, the accelerated depreciation, depending on how generous it is, will get applause from the business community, despite complaints it should have come earlier. It's possible, though not certain, the government might also accelerate personal tax cuts. The leaked story in The Australian last weekend about possible changes to the petroleum resource rent tax was obviously to make sure it doesn't happen, and it would have been tricky for a government which keeps emphasising the negatives of increased taxes. But it is also true that there's even less revenue after all to meet all these raised community expectations. How much does that matter? The federal system is, of course, one of the worst in the world for attempting such major national reforms, and an increasingly unwieldy one. Canberra gets much of the blame for practical failures, which are actually more the responsibility of the state governments. Blame shifting for school education standards and deteriorating results are a particularly pernicious perennial that seems unlikely to change. So the arguments over the adequacy of the land clearing measures and preparedness of fire management for the bushfires are just the latest example of this. But the public, more than ever in this age of media all the time, everywhere, wants the image and reassurance of national leadership from their national government, particularly in a time of crisis. Morrison misread this and has been rushing to respond in a frenetic blitz of activity and appearances. Now, the inevitable delays and complaints about the recovery from the destruction of the bushfires will be an obvious danger for the government, particularly one with a tarnished ability to project its national leadership skills. The government will focus on demonstrating compassion, whether on veterans' affairs or youth mental health, but I don't think the government's interest on social issues, such as the religious discrimination bill, will do much more than rile up all sides with little obvious benefit achieved in the eyes of the general public. So in the face of all this, what's the Prime Minister likely to do and what should he do? I think probably the most important change, which they're working on, is to excite people's attention with a narrative that makes them listen again and become persuaded the government does offer some answers to the sort of free-floating anxiety that I think is around in society at the moment, as well as the, you know, daily things of cost of living and household bills. Energy policy in this sense and the connection with emissions reduction policy might still not be the priority for a lot of households in outer suburbia. But there's no doubt many people are more concerned about the impact of climate change after this summer, and they somehow want more action from the federal government, even if they're not quite sure what that means. We saw the start of the corresponding policy shift with the Prime Minister's first set speech of the year promising a future of technology advance and the release of a new technology roadmap and working closely with business innovation on energy policy rather than the imposition of any new taxes. The party is behind him on this, the Liberals at least. Yet the scepticism about how this will work is, if anything, more pronounced in the business community than among his quiet Australians. And the government's image problem globally is obviously extreme now. The government will be under pressure to do more. Morrison will make a virtue of his steadiness, of the government's responsiveness, his ability to take practical actions that protect Australians and Australian jobs. He offers a strong defence of the national interest rather than submitting to any fashionable global ideologies, and I think this will remain key to his success and remain relatively popular, but he's got to be careful. I don't think all of this will be enough to make 2020, other than a very difficult year politically, and one of the best treading water economically, and probably, given what's been happening lately, much worse than that. And all of this is without the need to expect more of the unexpected. Possible bad news, much more likely than good. Black swans are no longer rare sightings. Thank you.
So, Paul Kelly, thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Gerard. It's great to be back at the Sydney Institute with Gerard and Anne Henderson and to be sharing a platform with my friend Jennifer Hewitt. In 2019, Scott Morrison proved he was an election winner. In 2020, we will discover how good he is at governing. After the election, there was an expectation that Morrison would be a more successful Prime Minister than either Tony Abbott or Malcolm Turnbull. He offered a practical, down-to-earth, community-based leadership with the prospect of uniting the Liberal Party and the Coalition. But the past 2 months have cast a dark shadow over such expectations. Morrison made a series of uncharacteristic mistakes. Many of his colleagues are surprised at the blunders we saw from the Prime Minister over the summer. His authority has been damaged. The bushfires were both a leadership test and an opportunity for leadership, and Morrison was found wanting. The damage was accentuated by the sports rorts affair that created a domino effect. The resignation of Bridget McKenzie triggered a leadership eruption in the National Party, with Barnaby Joyce unsuccessfully challenging Michael McCormack. The Nationals are left in a state of permanent schism, with Matt Canavan joining Joyce on the backbench, a recipe for guaranteed instability. The National Party crisis has a long way to run, and Michael McCormack will struggle to survive as leader. What does all this mean for 2020? It tells us the year begins in a very different way to what the government expected just a short time ago. Instead of a confident Prime Minister living off his enhanced authority from the remarkable election victory, both Morrison and his government are on the defensive. Their vulnerability is exposed. Their critics smell Morrison's weakness. Labour has been ahead in the two previous news polls, and Labour leader Anthony Albanese heads Morrison on personal tests of leadership. The past 2 months provide a sobering reminder of the times. They are above all unpredictable in Australia and in the world. From the coronavirus that has suddenly exposed the flaws in China's governance, to the victory of Boris Johnson in the British election in terms of its magnitude, to the consequences of Morrison taking a holiday in Hawaii, let alone the Donald Trump phenomenon. This is a wild and rapidly moving political world where nearly all past assumptions of the existing order are under challenge. There are no guarantees any longer, from the economy to climate change. Both Morrison and Albanese operate in broken traffic, anxiously trying to discern the public mood. Australia is a fractured country. The 2019 election result proved that. 2020 will provide much more evidence. The divisions between regional Queensland and Melbourne's leafy suburbs constitute two cultures in one nation. These divisions inevitably feed into the major parties institutionalising tension and division. The 2020 year will reveal the true character of the Morrison government. This is when the policies and outlook it will take to the next election will need to be advanced and developed. The number one issue is the economy. Morrison was elected in 2019 off the back of his economic credentials, compared with Labor's tax experiment and big spending agenda. If the economy slips into recession, that becomes a dire survival threat for Morrison. But recession in 2020, as distinct from one possible quarter of negative growth, is unlikely. However, the economic challenge is daunting because the mix of globalisation and the digital age has cancelled past patterns of economic behaviour. Reserve Bank Governor Phil Lowe delivered an optimistic outlook last week. Growth of 2.75% for this year, 3% for next year, an improvement. Unemployment falling below 5%. Interest rates staying low for a relatively long time. But Lowe had a grim message on wages, stuck for some time on annual increases of 2%. Neither a crisis nor a confidence booster. This means an economy defined by growth going into corporate profits and jobs, but living standards, household incomes and retirement incomes stay under pressure. That's a political problem. The public will remain anxious, frustrated, with many people unhappy. In this economic situation, there is no silver bullet, and I believe no quick fix. The pressing truth for the government is that it doesn't know, given the coronavirus, where the budget will finish in May. But if the promised surplus does disappear, that will be another blow to be exploited by the government's critics. Productivity is poor, and most productivity-enhancing measures are either unpopular or come with big-time delays. The public has no taste for economic reform, and the Senate is reform-resistant. Morrison has not the slightest interest in the futility of announcing reforms and seeing them thwarted in the Parliament. All pain, no gain. The big economic question is whether an economic slowdown warrants a declared change in fiscal policy. Short of that, I think economic policy will be a project in incrementalism. There will be investment tax breaks for corporates in the budget. That is a given. The risk is that growth will stay below trend and the Reserve Bank's optimism will not be validated. This is certainly the view of many private sector forecasters. The further risk is the government will look too static, in office but not in control. Given the drought, bushfires, the coronavirus, and an uncertain global outlook. This scenario would feed into another dangerous perception starting to take hold, that Morrison lacks conviction, that he's a leader for marketing, not for policy substance. I don't think that's accurate, but the 2020 year should provide a documented answer. There are several related areas of economic policy. It's critical for the industrial relations agenda that the Ensuring Integrity Bill, when reintroduced, is passed. That largely depends on Senator Jackie Lambie. Pauline Hanson sank this measure at the end of last year to teach Morrison a lesson. But the modest yet worthwhile IR reform agenda Morrison and Christian Porter devised will suffer a major blow if the first bill, the Ensuring Integrity Bill, can't get up. Superannuation will be a critical issue this term, with the review commissioned by Josh Frydenberg. My best guess here is that Morrison will not tamper with the existing law under which the super levy rises to 12%. Why would he? First, he would battle to legislate the change. Second, the argument would be that employers would respond by increasing wages. Do you think for a moment Morrison would trust corporate Australia to do this? And third, it would trigger a huge political fight at the next election with Labor and the unions, and I don't think Morrison would choose such a fight on such a ground. On services, Morrison's commitment to funding health and education will remain. He's not a big spender, but he's not a cutter. The question is whether he tackles the structural issues in health and the appalling situation in schools where standards fall despite generous funding. I'm not confident. Morrison will advance his commitment to the National Disability Insurance Scheme, mental health and veteran suicide. He believes in these approaches with a passion. On Indigenous issues, Morrison wants a referendum on Indigenous recognition, but will not countenance putting a voice to Parliament into the Constitution. Whether a viable referendum question can be devised is problematic. Whether the voice to Parliament will be legislated also remains uncertain. The second overarching area I want to mention is climate change. Morrison is going to run here a compromise, centrist, shifting strategy that will evolve according to domestic and global pressures. I think the main elements are being more credible on Australia's emission reduction efforts, an essential requirement for Liberal MPs in the major capital city seats. Framing emissions reduction policy as consistent with avoiding the sacrifice of jobs and industry. Having a policy response sensitive to different states and regions, not a grand one-size-fits-all national pricing scheme. Sticking by the 26% target for 2030, but moving towards a new target for the period beyond 2030 to be presented at the Glasgow summit later this year. Putting an emphasis on technology, not taxes, as the solution, and having the demonstration effect of falling energy prices. This is essential. Promoting gas as a transition fuel and avoiding being trapped into taking sides on a coal versus renewable binary contest. The government will seek to extend the life of existing coal-fired power stations, but I doubt it will bankroll a new coal-fired facility, we shall see. But that means big trouble with the Queensland Nationals, and it raises the question whether Morrison can hold together his 2019 electoral coalition. Remember, Morrison's task on climate policy is to minimise the damage, to neutralise Labor's ascendancy on the issue. The coalition can't beat Labor on climate, but it needs to be able to limit the votes it loses on the left and also the right. Some final thoughts. I think Morrison's risk is that he's defined as an incrementalist prime minister. That's very different from Trump and Johnson. Now, I'm not suggesting he should duplicate them, but Trump and Johnson are bold leaders promoting change, whether you agree or disagree with them. Remember, Morrison won in 2019 because he judged the Australian people didn't want fundamental change. He reasoned they just wanted sound and competent government, and he was right on that point. Morrison is really fixated on his 2019 election promises and honouring them. That's good. But those promises aren't enough to sustain him through this term. He needs in 2020 to signal what are the new directions and policies that will define him. And that's probably his single biggest challenge as Prime Minister. Now, in these comments, I focused on the government, not Labor. But Labor faces deep challenges over its strategy, policy, and unity. Labor is on a trajectory of structural and cultural decline. Albanese's effort to move the party back to the centre will be resisted by the Labor rank and file and will be exploited by the Greens. Politics is more difficult to read these days. Separating the daily drama from the long-run trend is a very tricky task. Morrison knows one thing above all. If he looks more reliable and credible than Labor, then he wins. My final point is to recall the two competing realities in our political life. What Morrison refers to as the Canberra bubble. The 2019 year exposed the gulf between the outlook of the political class, the politicians and the media on one hand, and the outlook of the public on the other. What the political media tells you about politics might not be what the public thinks. Thank you.
So, many thanks to our two speakers, two of the most important commentators in Australia. So it's great to have Sydney Institute. Thanks also to King and Wood Medicines for the use of this very fine facility tonight. So we'll just get our two speakers back. Jennifer, you come over here. Paul, you stay on this side of the microphone, and we'll lead off. I'll operate from over here. Just go back on both of your papers. As I recall, if you go back before the bushfires, go back to sort of November, the criticism of the government really was, and I think the Reserve Bank probably had this view, I think the criticism was that there should be more infrastructure spending, and Josh Frydenberg wanted to protect the surplus, which he has done, we would think. But what's happened, seen to me, after the bushfires is that we're going to get this infrastructure spending, which is going to be very substantial in parts of Victoria, parts of New South Wales, parts of Queensland, and perhaps elsewhere. So how does that affect it, this $2 billion amount of money, and there probably is going to be more that's going to be spent over the next months, years?
Well, actually, in terms of infrastructure spend, $2 billion isn't that much. When Philip Lowe kept calling for more infrastructure spending last year, the government... It wasn't just the Morrison government that was slightly irritated. You also had the Andrews government and the Berejiklian government here pointing out the obvious, which was, in fact, in the major cities in particular, There was a huge infrastructure project going on that was already risking, total constraints of, whether of labour, materials, absolutely everything. So I do think sometimes that Philip Lowe says things, kind of quite sensibly as an economist, but he never gets down into the details of actually how these things are going to work. So yes, I do think that we will see more infrastructure spending in regional Australia, and that way that may help. But the states alone are spending, the government keeps talking about $100 billion spend on infrastructure over a decade. Well, New South Wales and Victoria, and I think maybe Queensland, are spending kind of 180 or something over 4 years. So that just kind of gives you some context. But again, this whole thing about federalism in Australia is that nobody really knows who's responsible for what. And so at the moment, the Morrison government, having got a lot of the acclaim for things that, it now gets all the blame, even if it's things that are actually beyond its control because of this failure to persuade people about leadership in the last couple of months.
Or do you make a comment?
Yeah. If the economy gets into serious trouble, the way you fix it is you put money into people's pockets. Now, we're not in that situation. We're talking about infrastructure because we're not in a crisis. We want to try and improve the strength of the economy, but infrastructure's always got a lot of time lags. Now, we're living through an extraordinary period in terms of the behaviour of the Reserve Bank and the relationship between the Reserve Bank and the government. We've got a governor who was prepared to publicly make it absolutely clear that he wants more action from the government of the day. Now, this has led to a deep sense of private frustration on the part of senior ministers with the bank. And I think the style and approach of the bank is something we haven't seen in the modern period. I've written before, there's no way Ian Macfarlane as governor would have behaved the way Phil Lowe behaves as governor in terms of these public statements. Macfarlane would deal with the government in private. Phil Lowe deals with the government both in public and in private. And one of the fundamental questions, of course, is how accurate and reliable are the bank's forecasts? The bank has got the economy wrong over the last couple of years. There are very contentious views about its interest rate management in recent years. And Lowe this week has come out with very optimistic growth forecasts for the next couple of years.
So the question down here. Yeah, Paul, just say pretty well where you are. Yep.
All right. During these horrible and uncertain times, how can Scott Morrison make Australians feel relaxed and comfortable, to use a John Howard phrase?
He can't, because the times are different. That's one of the points I made. Australians like to feel relaxed and comfortable, and a lot of people, no doubt, through the summer did feel that way. But essentially, we've got all these disturbances now, which mean that sort of comment made 20 years ago is no longer as relevant as it once was.
Jennifer?
Well, we saw a kind of Morrison's version of it when he said he wanted to talk to people and govern for people who didn't think about politics much at all in their daily lives, and that this was a virtue in many ways about Australians. The trouble is, while I understand that, and that's still kind of a view amongst some of the government, the fact that there is this just general uncertainty about where things are headed makes that only works if people are kind of relaxed in a sense about the country's future direction. And right now, I think there's just a lot more apprehension about that than there was, and that kind of affects everybody, even if they're on a day-to-day basis and mainly worried about their household bills.
Question up there? Yeah.
I just wonder, in all of this debate, we talk about leadership and whatever, to what extent is the problem about the economy more the whole dead weight of bureaucracy? Trump did an enormous amount of freeing up the American economy by getting rid of a whole lot of regulatory legislation that was weighing down expansion of industry, whatever. And it seems to me, when I look around the little I know about the public service here, and just even the idea of getting things done after the bushfires, not even knowing now where the money's gone in many of the collections, we do have a problem where bureaucracy has become a completely leaden burden to things being done. How long does it take to get approval for a project? How long does it take to get something built? To what extent do we have to reform the public service to get us going again?
We'll lead off with Paul and we'll go to Paul.
I think the Federation is really important in terms of the answer to that question. A lot of approvals and a lot of regulation is done at state level. So you've got duplication between federal and state, and you've got the same problem. You've got over-regulation at both levels. So it's a multiple problem. And governments keep saying that they have a deregulatory agenda, they are reviewing regulations, they make these commitments all the time. The reality is, I think, once regulation is put in place, it's very difficult to unwind.
Probably like Paul, I feel as if I've been hearing this stuff about reducing bureaucracy forever. It never seems to happen. And I do think the federal system that we have is particularly bad at reducing that. I see that the New South Wales government is trying to put up a paper run by David Thodey. About financial state regulations or financial state relationship, and including getting rid of a lot of regulation. And I just think, well, actually, you could do it at state level for a start, rather than all the kind of the blame shifting that goes on. I notice Ben Morton, who is obviously kind of quite personally close to the Prime Minister and is his assistant and in charge of deregulation. He is targeting very specific and in a sense, you know, significant but quite small-scale things rather than any broad agenda. And I do think that Australia in general just becomes mired in this, but I don't see any real appetite to change it.
Richard?
The United States federal system is very different, where the states are much more proud of their independence than in Australia, and I don't recall there being anything like this type of a problem. In prior years, the states used to raise their own income tax. There's no reason I could see why states shouldn't declare an income tax rate that they would like to have, collected by the Commonwealth. Administration would be easy. But then you would have the necessary competitive situation between the states to be as efficient as they could, and there would be no further reason for the inertia, the hopelessness that you've both talked about, where there is this blame game, which seems to me to be a product of the federal government wanting too much power instead of recognising a federation should work where states are independent.
Okay, so Jennifer? Go back to the 1940s and restore income tax.
Some time ago. And of course, the other problem is that we've had this dream in Australia that services should be similar, basically, across the country. I mean, obviously, that doesn't work entirely, but the way that we've done that is by subsidising a lot of the poorer states. And so you do see a much greater variety in the states amongst the states than you do here. I think obviously that has some disadvantages, but I must say that my frustration level at how federalism is working for this country at the moment does lead me down the idea of thinking that we should become more like the US model, but I kind of doubt that'll happen.
Well, remember, in the early part of 2016, Malcolm Turnbull floated the idea of the states sharing income tax powers. That idea lasted probably about 12 hours before it was shot down in flames with the political row that subsequently eventuated. Well, that tells you the condition of Australian politics, and that tells you how difficult it is to have a discussion about a new idea, or in this case, if you like, an old idea. I think there's a reluctance on the part of the states to accept fiscal responsibility. Sometimes they talk about the idea of getting more income tax powers, but a lot of the time they don't want that because extra responsibility and extra danger comes with that sort of idea. I think the states are ambivalent about that. Certainly the Federation is in a real mess, and we do need to try and bring the parties together to have some sort of dialogue and work out some sort of consensus position for reform, even if it's only modest reform.
Just come up.
Thank you both. Paul, you mentioned the difference between what the political media and the politicians think in Canberra, the Canberra bubble, and versus what the people in the electorates are actually thinking. Which of the parties has got a better system of trying to determine what the people are actually thinking? Now, Labor prided itself, supposedly, on having a great system, but it seems maybe in the last election, Liberals did.
Well, look, I think that I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know if the politicians would know the answer to that question either. Certainly, this competing reality was fundamental last term, because Labor believed all the way through the last term it was in a winning position, and it devised policies, bold taxation policies, and it believed that those policies were being accepted by the people off the back of the polls and the by-elections, and that was a misinterpretation of what was happening. So this idea of actually being in touch with where public opinion is, as distinct from where the political debate is absolutely fundamental. Both sides recognise that. In terms of answering your question, which side is best equipped to get on top of that? Well, I don't know, but I'd say they're both working at it.
Jennifer?
I would say neither, pretty clearly. Although what I did think Morrison did show last year was that they were able to get in contact with more of the people in those outer suburban seats who were, you know, and when, I mean, he said quiet Australians for a very good reason. So in that sense, I think they were more effective at that, although obviously they had, you know, all sorts of other reasons, so, you know, the Queensland vote and things like that. But, I mean, if you look at a state like Victoria, where the Labor Party was incredibly confident of picking up a lot of seats, they just missed that entirely. And they also thought, mistakenly, I think, that big swings in inner suburban seats and the anger against the Morrison government in inner suburban seats, safe coalition seats, would be enough to swing them, when clearly it wasn't. And they neglected, absolutely, the outer areas where Morrison did much better in.
Question up here?
Yeah.
Leaving the Nats to one side, where does the "I'm not relying on the evidence" view come from for the Liberal Party? Is it driven by their view of what's electorally satisfactory for them? You know, why do they not believe in the inconvenient truth?
Oh, Paul?
Can we have more clarity on the question, though? I think I've got the question, but
yeah, it's around climate change, yeah. Right? I mean, I think my sense there are members of the Liberal Party that are happy to toe a particular line that I'm not sure necessarily don't believe in climate change.
Well, I think the answer is it works both ways. I think there is a very small number of coalition MPs who are genuine sceptics, but for the majority, there is a political problem that's to be negotiated and to be thought through, and it's a very daunting political problem, given that the coalition's constituency stretches from regional Queensland to leafy Melbourne. So this is a daunting political challenge, and I went through in my presentation essentially the sort of parameters that Morrison is adopting on this. He's attempting to follow what I call a shifting compromise centrist position, which will move about depending upon the international and domestic debate.
One of the things that I was struck by, I was talking to a minister last week, and this was after they just had a kind of quite heated discussion in the coalition party room about, you know, coal and climate change. And this person said to me, well, look, the thing is that's still within the guidelines, and it was reasonably civil, and it was still within the guidelines of what the Prime Minister said. But, of course, it was only within the guidelines because Scott Morrison's keeping it so broad that, you know, he can kind of almost encompass anything at the moment. But I think that is changing and will have to change. And my prediction will be, like Paul, that this government kind of hates the idea of symbolism in some ways. I mean, a tradition in some that goes back to Howard on kind of progressive issues doesn't like to be seen to do it, and they keep saying, just judge us by what we do. You know, we beat our targets, all of that. I think, however, you'll see the government come to the position, despite the angst in the Nationals, that they're going to have to move on 2050. I don't think, like Paul, I don't think they'll move on the 26 to 28%, but they'll keep talking about how they're going to beat that. And then, like a lot of other governments who've got no clue how to get there, they'll move on 2050. Morrison saying, well, I won't do anything until I know what it costs the Australian people is ludicrous in the sense that nobody could have a clue what any of this costs given all the changes. But I think they'll be manoeuvring around that.
So we've come to Dobbin time. You're both Sydney-based, but how come so many of your colleagues, particularly in Canberra, got the election so wrong? How could that come about? Jennifer?
Well, you know, I do think, as I said, we're all a bit more sceptical about polling these days. But it did turn out to be... it was close. The polls really did get it wrong, so I think we kind of got lulled into this sense. But so did the government to some extent. I mean, Morrison was always, you know, they kind of thought if everything went right, if absolutely everything, there was a narrow path to victory. So it wasn't as though they were kind of overconfident about it, even Morrison. And the Labor Party, of course, just, I think, completely missed the plot and then referred, I mean, in a way more culpably, I think, absolutely refused to acknowledge what was happening in Queensland because they kept hoping, you know, what turned out to be very silly, make silly assumptions about how they could win in Victoria and even in Western Australia, which of course went really bad for them in the last couple of weeks. So I think they went into the election thinking that it was theirs to be won, and nothing really altered that because they refused to acknowledge anything that at the end their polling was showing them. But I did hear stories that even at the last couple of days before the election, you know, the Liberals also, you know, their polling wasn't showing that they were anything like certain victory.
Well, I think a lot of people got the last election wrong. Most notably the Labor Party, and wide sections of the media. Now, the thing that strikes me about this is, in relation to the media, I think this has got to be the most serious collective election failure on the part of the media that I've seen in my time in politics. And I'm not exempting myself when I talk about the media. I mean, I'm obviously part of the media. I just want to stress that point. But most of the media got the politics wrong, they got the policies wrong, and they got the mood of the country wrong. And when you make mistakes of that magnitude, you would normally expect that after the election, there would be a process of revision and reassessment on the part of the media which would be demanded by the leaders of the media. Now, perhaps such a process has occurred, but if it's occurred, it must have been conducted in secret, because I certainly know nothing about it. And I think it's very interesting that the media hold politicians to account whenever the politician makes a relatively modest mistake. And not only that, they urge a rethink on the part of the politician. Well, I think we're living in an age of extraordinary double standards.
Just one more point on that. Of course, this didn't just happen in Australia. I mean, if you look at what happened in the US and the UK, and I think in that sense, it just demonstrates that the media, in many ways, is part of that, you know, the political establishment, and very few of them are clearly going to be out there in outer suburbs looking at what people think, whether it's in the US or the UK or here.
Now we're getting towards the end. We go to Peter, then we go to Mike. See how we go, Peter. Just come back in.
Thanks very much. We seem to be living in this surreal era where there's a wholesale breakdown of trust. And trust in the banks, trust in business, trust in the media, trust in the politicians, evidence for the sports rorts and so on. And we're seeing it here in the churches. It's like, what's going on? And it's like no one seems to care, if you look at it globally, in the sense of what, you know, the Trump phenomenon produces. And surely there's an opportunity there for perhaps renewing the ethical infrastructure of the country.
Renewing ethical infrastructure. How many billions does that cost?
Well, it might all be free if there's no price tag attached to it. But, Peter, look, that's a really critical point. I mean, there is a breakdown of trust, and it's not just about politics, obviously, as you indicated. It's right across the society. So we're talking not just a political problem, we're talking about a deep social and cultural problem in our nations, and this is clearly afflicting, many countries in the Western world. And, seems to me what's happening is the concept of shared values has disintegrated. And the issues the glue that held our societies together has now fallen apart. And so if you don't agree on the fundamentals, then your society is going to be heading towards all sorts of differences, disputes, and lack of trust, and I think that's where we are.
I agree with Paul on that idea of social glue kind of evaporating as everybody kind of goes down into their own quite narrow interests. There's a whole lot of reasons for that, and not least of which being the behaviour of many of the people who were supposed to be demanding our trust and respect, you know, whether it's the churches, whether it's business leaders, whether it's politicians. I do think it's kind of quite amusing that you now see this kind of great emphasis from the business community, big business in particular, about how, you know, we're all going to want to be totally ethical now, having kind of ignored that area really largely for quite some time, or being seen to ignore it in many cases. But I also think that the other issue that is part of this general dynamic is the growth of media all the time, social media all the time, everywhere. And that does encourage, I think, that ability of people to kind of go into their own, you know, particular own bubbles and only listen to people they agree with. The polarisation of society is very common across the Western world. So it's polarisation in one sense, but also it's just separate people kind of shouting at one another, much more so than ever before.
Final question, Michael. Okay. Okay, let's just have a go, Michael.
Well, thank you both. To your point, Jennifer, I think being No, it's flat.
Okay. Come on.
Jared, you relate, if you would. Firstly, what does Adam Bant mean for the Greens, and should we expect the return of the expanding Clive at the next?
So the question is, what does Adam Bant mean for the Greens, and should we expect a return of big spending Clive Palmer before the next election? So let's start with Jennifer and finish with Paul.
Well, I don't think you'll see the return of big spending Clive, even though he'll obviously may spend a lot more money. I think, you know, last time proved he was very important in getting preferences to the coalition, but that was it. So I doubt it. On the other hand, these days I'm much more cautious about saying anything won't happen in politics. In terms of Adam Bant, I think he's going to be a lot more aggressively pursuing climate change agenda. You already saw the language about business killing people and things like that. So increasing the kind of deliberately trying to increase the sense of division in society, and particularly off the back of the changing mood of climate change. I think that's... That still gives Morrison, the coalition government, room to move a little bit without, and I think Labor is actually more concerned about Adam Bant than the Morrison government.
I have no idea what Clive Palmer will do, and I doubt anyone else does either. In relation to Adam Bant, as Jennifer said, he's going to be much more aggressive, much more extreme. I think what it means is that this could pose a significant problem for Labor, because Albanese's got to move more to the centre. But the problem with that is that the Labor rank and file is progressive, and the progressives in the community and in the media won't like that. So the Greens are therefore positioned to really exploit any Labor shift towards the centre, particularly any such Labor shift on climate change. So that is going to be a difficult issue for Labor to negotiate. In terms of the Greens, I think we're now in a position where the Greens have peaked. Remember, when Di Natale became leader, he had these grandiose plans. I can't remember exactly what he said, but, you know, the Greens were going to expand. They were going to move into the House of Representatives. They were going to significantly increase their vote. Well, their vote stuck on 10%, and I don't think it's going to rise much above 10%. And I think that the election of Adam Bant will reinforce that. So the loyalists, the climate change loyalists, will stick with the Greens, and he'll win those people. There's no question at all about that. But I think the days of the Greens moving into the sunlit uplands of expansion look to me to be over. The other point to make about this is his rhetoric is really divisive. This is really damaging, inflammatory rhetoric. And Pauline Hanson is always held to account by the media for her rhetoric and her policies. It's about time the media started to apply equal scrutiny and equal evaluation of the Greens and their rhetoric.
Many thanks to both of you. Thank you. We had more questions, but we always finish on time and we're right on time. So thanks to our speakers for keeping to their time and for... also keeping their comments brief in question time. Look, there are a lot of people here tonight. I just want to make one point. The Sydney Institute, we're very grateful. The two highly respected and well-informed columnists and commentators like Paul Kelly and Jennifer Hewitt have made their time tonight to speak to us on a range of issues and given a lot of insights. And I think all of us here have learned something. And so my challenge is we'd love to have you back at the start of next year and see how we go then. But for tonight... thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.